Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Shimon Peres is one of those people who fought for Israel before it even existed. At the age of 26 in the War of Independence, he was acting Secretary of the Israeli Navy. He worked closely with Israel's first Prime Minister, David Ben-Gurion. Some decades later, Peres himself became Prime Minister of Israel. He has also held the portfolios of immigration, transportation, information, and defense, though he is best known for his tenure as foreign minister, helping shepherd the Middle East as close to peace as it has ever been in our lifetime. For that work, he shared a Nobel Peace Prize. But that was 10 years ago. Since then, Mr. Peres has watched a succession of party leaders and prime ministers struggle against increasing violence and apply their own tough military solutions. It's been a difficult time to be a peacemaker in the Middle East. Next week, the Knesset convenes for an historic vote on the latest plan to pull Israeli settlers out of Gaza. It has precipitated an unprecedented level of anger and division among Israelis. Now, Shimon Peres is with us this hour, and we invite you to join our conversation. Whatever happened to those who dreamed of peace in the Middle East? What's next in relations between Israel and the United States, Arab states, and Europe? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest is the former Prime Minister of Israel and current leader of the Labour Party, Shimon Peres. Thank you for coming to the studio.
Thank you very much.
I don't know how many people know that this is a return to Boston for you. You were a student here over 50 years ago.
That's right. I have been the AMP of Howard, and I have had the most agreeable time in my life, 3.5 months here.
I want to talk to you about life in Israel today, and I want to tell you what little we know. We see and hear about posters of the prime minister with the words madman written on it. We hear him accused of being a Nazi collaborator. We hear talk of civil war, rabbis calling on soldiers not to serve, generals saying that this would be a disaster. How bad is it?
It's bad enough, but they are rather vocal than effective. They represent a minority in the Israeli life and public opinion, and I think they do harm to themselves by overstating, by exaggerating, by using the wrong language. People don't like it. And in spite of all their threat and warnings, there won't be a civil war in Israel. The majority will decide. You know, always when you have a majority and minority, the minority is strong in voices, the majority is strong in votes.
But something is serious enough in Israel for you to speak out and say that you are afraid of an assassination attempt on the prime minister. You are afraid, tell me if I'm quoting you incorrectly, but I think you said that you felt in the country a return to the same feeling of the mid-90s, back at the time when Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated.
That's right. I did it really to alarm ahead of time and to call for better security to guarantee the life of the prime minister, and also to tell the people who are introducing so much incitement in our life to lower their voices. I believe the security for the prime minister was enhanced. I hope nothing will happen to him. And finally, it is not the many voices that criticize the prime minister, but a single person that get crazy and kills somebody. It happens here, it happens elsewhere, and we have to prevent it.
But this, in many ways, is your daily dilemma now as an opposition leader, because in a vibrant democracy, it is the job of an opposition leader to oppose, to say, no, I disagree with the direction of the government. And I'm interested in hearing you describe how you see your job differently in Israel, because sometimes you oppose the prime minister. Sometimes you consider joining his coalition, a unity government, a national government. Does that mean it's different to be an opposition politician in Israel?
Yes. I mean, we are in opposition to the government. We are not in opposition to peace. And we have to distinguish between the two different approaches. And for me, country comes first, party comes second. The government makes enough mistakes to satisfy an opposition. But once the Likud party split and half of the party, headed by the prime minister, supports our ideas, why should we oppose? Today, Mr. Sharon speaks exactly like I used to speak, say, 5 or 10 years ago. The fact that he's the spokesman and not me is not an important difference. It is the language and the intention that I support. And, you know, I think that his proposal is not a very brilliant one, the unilateral disengagement. But I prefer a mediocre proposal that comes from the Likud and has a majority than a brilliant proposal that comes from Labour and doesn't enjoy a majority. So my responsibility is toward peace, toward making steps toward peace, small steps, long steps, doesn't matter.
Let me ask you about a recent event in Israel, the latest incursion of the Israeli, the IDF, into Gaza. There were dozens, up to 100 Palestinians killed in that. There were a number of Israelis who were killed at the same time. And as the leader of the opposition, as the leader of the Labour Party, how much of you wants to say, this is wrong? We should not have such a strong military presence in Gaza at the time when we're talking about disengagement, because this is a place where you have to make the choice. You choose not to criticize the prime minister.
We criticize him differently. We say, okay, when you have threats of terror or acts of terror, you have to fight back. But we think that simultaneously, in a parallel manner, you have to conduct the negotiations. We think it's not enough to fight terrorists, you have to fight the reasons for terror. And the reasons for terror are rather political more than military one. The idea of Mr. Sharon is, first of all, fight terror, and then we shall see what will happen politically. By doing so, you cannot mobilize the Palestinians, in our judgment, to participate in the struggle against the terrorists themselves. And we say, fight terrorists as though you wouldn't have a problem about the political negotiations, and have a political negotiation in spite of the fight against terror.
And what about the people who say that you have moved away from your determination to find peace? What about the people who say that you have become too close to Sharon, to his more tough military approach in dealing with the Palestinians?
My answer is that they look upon it as a personal matter, and they look upon it as a national matter. If Sharon goes the way I think he has to go, why shouldn't I support him? Because of personal differences. So I criticize when Sharon goes, in my judgment, in the wrong direction. I support him unhesitatingly when he's right. You see, the idea that politics is a game like baseball, where you have Red Sox and you have Yankees, is not the same story. It's not a game. It's a struggle of a people to achieve peace. And a man like myself, not only myself, have to judge every morning what serves peace, what doesn't serve peace. And what people are saying, they're saying, if you want to be popular all your life, better do nothing. If you want to be right, fight, even if you are being criticized. And I feel I'm doing my fight. I carry out my responsibility, in my judgment, totally honestly and sincerely.
This got very ugly back in 2002 when the fighting was in places like Jenin and Tulkarm. And at that time, if I recall, there were members of the Nobel Committee who said, oh, we should take away his Nobel Peace Prize because instead of speaking out for peace, he's agreeing with the government policy. I know that you've answered the question, but I'm curious to know how you bring the left wing, the people who are pushing for peace, along with you. Because you say you get up in the morning, you make a personal decision. This is good for the country, in my judgment. This is not good for the country, in my judgment. So if I'm a member of Shimon Peres's Labour Party, then I have to wake up every morning and wonder, which way are we going to go today?
My answer is I never did anything in my life in order to get a Nobel Prize. Nobel Prize for me was a surprise, never a purpose. Secondly, I shall answer my friends, look what happened. The Likud is adopting our way, not us adopting their way. And by our behavior, which is responsible and fair, we brought to a change in the Likud. After all, we don't want to be just theoretic advocates for peace. We want to create a majority. In order to have a majority, we need elements of the Likud. And deep in my heart, I think that our policy was successful. Not because everybody in Labor was satisfied, but because many in the Likud changed their minds, and that was the purpose. You see, I don't accept the idea, not only by the Nobel Prize, but also elections. I don't think the most important thing is to be elected. The most important thing is to change realities, one way or another way. I know many people who were elected and they didn't know what to do with their elections. They wasted their time. They were happy, they were praised, nothing came out. Better fight for something under different circumstances. Don't give up. So maybe I lost a lot of elections, but I never lost a cause. And deep in my heart, when I want to be satisfied with myself, I say, go on. Don't look upon prizes and victories as your main purpose. Look upon causes as your main goal.
And so whose judgment matters in the end? Clearly it's not members of the Nobel Committee, nor Europeans, nor perhaps Americans. Whose judgment matters?
You know, many people ask me if Sharon is serious, if I'm serious. We are not the masters of the world. It's a little bit illusionary. The world masters our destinies too. We serve an age. We serve realities. And I believe that the world has changed. And even if, for example, in Israel, you say, okay, let's stay where we are. Let's not move. Let's not give up. I mean, only Joshua could have stopped the sun from continuing to move around. The rest of us must understand that there is a mobility in life. If we shall stop, for example, our political movement, but the demography of Israel will be changed. We are on the verge of losing our majority. And nobody can give orders to mothers or to children. So unless we shall forecast what's going to happen, we shall deserve our people. We shall close our eyes. We shall be glorious, blind people. I prefer to give up a little bit of the glory, but have more open eyes to see the reality.
My guest this hour, former Prime Minister of Israel, current leader of the Labour Party, Shimon Peres. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. My guest this hour, Shimon Peres. He is currently a member of the Knesset. He's been a member of the Knesset now for the past 45 years. In that period of time, he has also been Prime Minister of Israel. He has held a number of portfolios, chief among them the Foreign Minister portfolio, at a time when he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, along with Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat in 1994. Although he says that that prize doesn't matter that much to him, it does matter to the world, and it does matter to all of us, because it marked a time when people were actually thinking about and talking about peace in the Middle East. We're doing that again on the program today, and Mr. Peres is here to take calls. We are going to our first caller in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Zach is joining us. Hello, Zach.
How are you doing?
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. And thank you for Mr. Shimon for making himself available for people to talk to and ask. I'm one of many Palestinians, which is the majority, who live outside of Israel, Palestine. And we come to conclusion, most of us, actually, to that the PLO failed as a revolution itself and as partners in peace. And we just, like, for the last 20, like, 30 years, we've been watching in the news, like, daily or on the radio, the situation just getting worse and worse. And we just look at the TV and we feel just hopeless. There's, like, things are going to the worst and we have no hope. And we're just sitting here, probably here or England or Germany or in Jordan, and we feel that we have no say in it.
Zach, have you a question for Mr. Peres?
Yes. Is there any way? I mean, we know that the PLO failed as a peace partner. Where do the Israelis go for and search for a peace partner that they could talk to and to give the majority, the 7 million Palestinians, hope that one day we're going to be actually returning home or just visiting, or we have peace partners that we could talk to? Is there any particular person or group that the Israelis feel comfortable talking to about peace
now? Zach, thanks for your call.
Well, I think you're a little bit over-pessimistic, because many things happened that are positive for the Palestinians and for us. Let me just mention one or two of them. You know, the roadmap is quite sensational from the Palestinian point of view, because the whole world recognized there is a need to establish a Palestinian state on the side of the state of Israel. And, strangely enough, the Likud party that opposed all the time the establishment of a Palestinian state is today for it. And we know more or less where the line of the frontier will run between the two states. Actually, we have a solution, an agreed solution for the future. You may ask, if you have an agreed solution for the future, why don't you have an agreement? And the answer is because of the mistakes we committed in the past. We, the Israelis, committed a mistake by the map of settlements, which is very hard to incorporate in the map of peace. And you, the Palestinians, by not controlling the terroristic groups that are frustrating the policies and destiny of the Palestinian people. There are persons that we can talk with, headed, by, in my judgment, by the present Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority, Mr. Abu Ala, whom I consider a very serious and intelligent person. I believe he wants peace, he wants to stop terror. And we on the Israeli side have to offer what to talk about. The Palestinians have to offer with whom to talk, and we have to offer what to talk. But it's not the end of the world, and the hope that in spite of the Intifada, which is very painful for you, the Palestinians, for us, your children are being killed, our children are being killed. It's terrible. A child is a child. Doesn't matter if it's a Jewish or a Palestinian. We have to guarantee their future and save their lives. But good things happened too. And I believe the roadmap will remain the guiding line for the future to the satisfaction of your people and our people.
Although the policy that Zach hears, not only from the Israeli government, but from this administration, is that Arafat, and by extension his administration, they are not partners in peace. They are not to be spoken to, not to be dealt with. I understand his pessimism, because the other side of the table is being told not that they are not a part of the conversation anymore.
The Palestinians are saying that they cannot do without Arafat and they cannot do with him. So basically, Arafat is and will remain a Palestinian problem. But Arafat does not prevent Abu Ala to talk with us. What we have to suggest is an agenda. And that's what I have mentioned, that we have to have an agenda. You know, people say it's not enough to kill the mosquitoes. Mosquitoes are supposed to be the terrorists. You have to dry the swamp. But it is not a swamp made of water. It is a swamp made of desperation. And we have to bring an end to the desperation on our side. And the Palestinians must bring an end to the armed division on their side. We started our efforts. I hope the Palestinians will do likewise.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Lafayette, Louisiana, Lee is on the line. Hello, Lee.
Yes, sir. Thank you for allowing me to be on Connections this morning.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I have a question. You know, looking at history and looking at all of the conflicts and the wars, whether it's in Ireland, the falling Yugoslavia, Iraq, and the Middle East, it seems to me that even though the greatest number of people in the world want peace, wouldn't it seem like religion is the dominant obstacle to all of these, you know, having peace in all of these conflicts? And if it is, then what do you think the solution is?
Well, I would a little bit disagree with you. I think it's not religion. It's fanatic religious people who are the problem. I do not believe that the Islam is for war. I think there are Muslims who are for war. I wouldn't say that every Muslim is for terror, so many of the terrorists are Muslims. And I think it's an inner problem for the Muslim world to overcome it. It used to be the same in the Catholic Church and the Protestant and Jewish, Buddhist, Communist. We are reaching an age where the changes are stemming from within, and the Muslims too don't have a choice but to join in a new age. And there are already Muslims that did it. The best example, in my judgment, is Turkey, where a Muslim party won the elections, and they are saying actually it can be Muslim and modern. There is no contradiction between the two. They want to enter the European Union. They gave human rights. They gave rights to the women. They became flexible on Cyprus. They keep a good relations with Israel. So there is an alternative. Most of the world stopped fighting. Today, the only war is done by individual terrorist, fanatic, and I think sooner or later, even the Palestinians and Muslims will get organized to fight the terrorists and the fanatics that brings upon them catastrophes upon catastrophes. The real victims of the terrorism is not just the targets that they attack, but the people they are coming from. And you can see already cracks in this situation. One thing is clear. With the end of the 20th century, the classical wars are over. There is no more a war of an army against an army, a nation against a nation. There is a war supported by individuals. They don't have a given place. They don't have rules. They don't have organizations. Their own advantages, they kill indiscriminately. And let me tell you,
I believe... They kill in the name of religion.
Of fanatic religion. There are different groups and streams in every religion. Religion is not on one piece of position. And I believe the United States will win the war in Iraq. And the real winner will be the Iraqian people. They will get rid of dictatorship, belligerency, and they will be able to live in peace with themselves and in peace with their neighbors.
I wonder, though, you spoke earlier about the importance of preserving the Jewish state by moving quickly to get firm and permanent borders before the numbers of Palestinians being born and overwhelm the number of Jews living in Israel. I wonder, in context of what Lee is asking, whether or not it is not always going to be difficult to defend the state of Israel because the state of Israel wants to be able to preserve its Jewishness in that part of the world.
In its Jewishness and being democratic. A Jewish state is not a religious definition. It is a democratic definition. A Jewish state means a state where the Jewish people are majority. If you should lose our majority, it won't be a Jewish state. As there are 22 states, Arab states, because the Arabs are a majority. And the Arabs may have 22 or 23 states. We have one state. And after going through history, suffering so much because we were Jews, because we were different, we think we are entitled to have a haven of ourselves, of our own, and defend it not only by army, but by democracy. And we don't want to face a choice that we shall be Jewish and not democratic, or we shall be democratic and non-Jewish. We are fighting for this double purpose.
1-800-423-TALK. That's the number to join my conversation this hour with the former Prime Minister of Israel, Shimon Peres. Next to Newton, Massachusetts, Miriam is with us. Hi, Miriam.
Hello. Thank you very much for allowing me to be on the program this morning. And welcome to your guest, Mr. Peres. I have two questions for you. One is, knowing what you know now and what we have seen and what we continue to see going on in Israel and the devastation of both peoples, if it were 1968, would you reconsider the whole question of giving back what would then call the territories? My second question is, what do you say to the assertion of Naomi Chazan that the move by Mr. Sharon to leave Gaza unilaterally is also a move to hang on to the West Bank permanently? Thank you.
Thanks, Miriam.
Thank you. I mean, on the first, you know, the choice before Israel is clear from its very first day of foundation. Either to have more land and endangering our majority, or to have a majority by giving back land. That was the dilemma by Ben-Gurion, and he made a clear choice. He says, let's better have an independent Jewish state on part of the land than the whole of the land without being sure that we can guarantee our majority. About Naomi Chazan, I can say one thing. Sharon changed. The consequence is that he can continue to be changed. You have to ask, why did he change? Because the world changed. Because the demographic situation changed. And nobody can stop it. So as Sharon changed until now, he will have to continue and change. He cannot stop the movement of our time. As I have said, all of us are subjected to the realities of our life.
You're listening to The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon. But to take that question one step further, do you know now which parts of the West Bank will end up as part of Israel? Which parts of the West Bank might be returned to Palestinians?
I think that's my view, that the line should be more or less the 67 border, minus, plus, with some alterations, with some solutions for Jerusalem. That's the real compromise, not only on the part of Israel, but also on the part of the Palestinians. What happened in Oslo, and in Oslo we did two things. We have a Palestinian partner, and we have a more or less agreed map. Because would Arafat insist on the borders of 1947 that's supposed to give to the Palestinians 45% of the West Bank, we would never have peace. Mm-hmm. He agreed to the 67 borders, which gives the Palestinians only 24%, so we have a map of compromise. And I do not believe that with all the maneuvers, you can depart far away from that line. So I know exactly what we have to do, and the division must pay attention to the population, not to the land. Land is neutral. People are making what the state is. And since most of the Palestinians are living, all of them are living on the West Bank and Gaza, we have to let them live in security, in respect, as good neighbors. As far as I'm concerned, I would say two things. A, I feel the better the Palestinians will have it, better neighbors we shall have. And then even if it would be strong, and would be able to keep the territories, it stands against our tradition. The Jews were not born to govern another people. It's quite hard to govern ourselves. And we don't want to remain the boss of anybody that doesn't want to be bossed by us. So because we want to keep our own tradition, which is basically a moral one, we cannot depart from it. We have to stop occupation. We have to stop submission, even if we can continue and do it for any length of time.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Somerville, Massachusetts, David is with us. Hi, David.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning, Mr. Peres.
Good morning.
the separation wall is creating a new hard line between the two territories. How do you see? At the same time, I think if this wall were being built on the 67 line, on the green line, the whole world would see that as a fair and equitable separation of territory. How do you get that wall closer to the 67 line, and try to institutionalize the fair separation that you're talking about?
I agree with your assumption, but may I compliment my government, so I'm in the position, that they moved now the fence very close to the 67 line that existed before. Today, the difference between the what we call the green line and the root of the fence is almost identical. So the government changed their minds. I think by changing, they did the right thing, because if it would be perceived as a security line, we wouldn't have problems. The minute it became pregnant with political ambitions, then problems began. And now I think we are correcting it.
Prime Minister Sharon says it's a temporary security barrier. Is it?
I think so too, because permanence resides in realities.
And the realities, as you were saying, are shifting.
The realities is that we have to have two states with a clear border.
1-800-423-8255. That's our telephone number. My guest this hour, former Prime Minister of Israel, current leader of the Labour Party, Shimon Peres. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. My guest this hour, Shimon Peres. He's the author of a number of books, including Battling for Peace, published in 1995. And he is still battling for peace, something that he began as defense minister and did as foreign minister, as prime minister. Some would say that it's becoming a more increasingly difficult battle with every day, sometimes, as it's seen, just within Israel, sometimes within the whole region. He's here. He's willing to answer your questions. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. Next to Framingham, Massachusetts, Ilan is with us. Hi, Ilan.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, and I want to say shalom to Mr. Peres.
Shalom.
I do admire you and all your public service in the country. My question to you, it seems like that in the past more than 10 years that the country itself was not united. No one seemed to try and have a way to unite the people, and it also chose the way the people were, getting the election every 2 years. And
are you saying, Ilan, that the country is becoming more and more fractured?
In some ways, I mean, if you take a look since Rabin was assassinated, the country's government has been changed. No prime minister have been able to finish 4 years of service as a prime minister. And my question to Mr. Peres is, why can the government, whoever gets elected, cannot get the united government?
Or how does a political leader in Israel unite the country?
Well, I think there are two answers to the question. One is our political system is far from being perfect. Instead of having a democracy with two or three parties, we have a democracy of 14 parties. So you have to negotiate on every possible subject a new coalition. And that introduces a great deal of instability in the government. I think one of the answers is really to change the electoral system, so we shall get to a point where we have just two alternatives, a government and an opposition. The other one, the issues are very serious. It's a matter of existence. It's not, you know, a usual political division. It's either life and death, so everybody takes it so seriously and so strongly. Now, if we want to be united, we have to become neutral. Neutral, too, is dangerous. You know, I've been to Iceland, and the prime minister there gave us a lovely dinner, and he said after the dinner, "We are the frozen people, you are the chosen people." We cannot become a frozen people, which may be union. We have to make a choice. By me, by saying the chosen people, I feel that we have to be a people that makes a choice. And the choice is difficult all the time because not everything depends upon us. It depends also upon our neighbors, upon the outside world. We are not in full control of the situation. And I think it's right to fight for peace. Israel divided the history of Israel in two parts. The first part, when the Arabs tried to overpower us, and they thought they have the strength. It went until 1973, the War of Yom Kippurim. And then all of us were united to fight the danger. Since 1973, when the Arabs, apparently many of them, gave up the hope to destroy us, a chance for peace arrived. And now we are working for peace and more divided. In face of a danger, you are united. In face of a choice, you are divided.
And yet the divisions that exist and are reflected within the Israeli political system are divisions which even make this country look united at the moment before an election. When you look at the dramatically different things that are being said by the settlers, by the ultra-nationalists, by people who were once members of the Peace Now camp, but at the same time you have reformist and observist parties representing. I know that there is a part of you that thinks that some greater purpose needs to be served and people need to set aside some of their differences, but I look at those differences in Israel, and I wonder whether or not that could ever happen.
If we would have two parties, some of the settlers would join in one party, another a different party. But when you fought in parties, the settlers joined in an existing party and make their position more vocal.
But how do you ever put them back in the box, though?
By changing the electoral system. And then make clear, no matter we are divided or not divided, mm-hmm. there's a majority and a minority. If the majority is becoming frightened, that's the end of democracy. A majority must have courage to defend not only the land, but also the system. And no matter how threatening the minorities may be, they are a minority, and they will not decide. The majority should not allow them to do so. You run a country either by ballots or by bullets. And we shall insist that our country will be run by ballots, not by bullets.
To Newton, Massachusetts, for our next call, and Avi is joining us. Hi, Avi.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I'm Israeli. I want to say Mr. Peres has had great contributions to the Israeli to the creation of Israel and to Israel's security over the years, and nobody can take that away from him. But even though I'm from a completely opposite side of the political spectrum in Israel, I read his article today in the Globe, and I really loved it. I think it's an excellent article. It explains how there is a lot of hope for peace in the Middle East. I want Mr. Peres to talk a little bit about that article, because I really think this is what he wrote there in the article is really where the hope for peace in the Middle East is.
You pin it on something. You pin your hope for Middle East on what's your starting point for that?
Yes, me.
Yeah. What is the starting point?
I think basically a change which is beginning to take place on the Arab side as well. I hope I'm objective, and I wouldn't like, to create a wrong impression. But I think Israel is trying to correct her past mistakes. And I do hope the Palestinians and the Arabs will do likewise, because they don't have a choice. They are the victims of their own mistakes. It's not because of us. We don't serve the Arabs don't serve us. Peace serves both of us.
But if the change that you describe is built on a form of exhaustion or despair, can that hold?
Not only despair, but hope. The Arabs and the Muslims cannot live in the past. They cannot make a living out of the past. They have to join in a new age, an age that makes its living out of science, that doesn't have borders and doesn't need walls, instead of living on the land, which was the real source of wars throughout history. The minute we live on an economy of the mind instead of an economy of the land, nobody has a choice but to join it in. It's only a matter of time. And I feel the Arabs begin to understand that time calls them not to stop being Arabs, not to stop being Muslims, but to become a modern country, a modern society for their own sake. Once this will happen, peace will come. You know, what happened in Europe? Europe was for hundreds of years experiencing bloodshed, hatred, suspicion. And in 2 or 3 years, you have a united Europe. And the French and the British and the Poles and the Germans are living differently. It can happen in the Middle East as well.
You're listening to The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon. Next call from Florence, South Carolina, and Alvin's with us. Hi, Alvin.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Thank you so much for having someone the caliber of Shimon Peres. I am a rabbi who's been to Israel probably 25, 30 times and have met in group meetings with the prime minister, the Central Conference of American Rabbis. And since my retirement and before, I've been involved with a group called A Different Future, which is trying to strengthen the voices of moderation on both sides of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. My question for the prime minister is this. I've been involved with a jillion different organizations, and sometimes it seems so futile. What is our best counterpart in Israel and in Palestine to partner with in our work here in the United States?
Do you mean what can Jews living in the United States do, or what can the United States do diplomatically?
Well,
or is it a bit of both?
A little bit of both, but primarily our group is made up of
Alvin, we're tight for time. I want to get to straight to Mr. Peres on this point, if I can.
Well, we have to have an involvement of the civil society in making peace. You know, peace should be privatized, not only remain a matter of governments. And there are a lot of things that you can do in the way of people to people, to have dialogues, to meet, to talk. We have a Paris Center for Peace. That's what we do. We have an ongoing dialogue in all domains, in health, in culture, in sports. We are now taking care of wounded Palestinian children. They don't have health insurance. They don't have hospitals. And if we save a life of a child who is 3 or 4 years old, he will spend the rest of his life to be an ambassador of goodwill and an ambassador of peace.
Does Israel need more involvement of the United States at the diplomatic level now?
The United States provided the so-called roadmap. The roadmap is finally the accepted solution by all parts. I imagine time has come to try and implement it, not by force, but by influence. I don't think that peace can be forced. I think peace should emerge from the bottom of our life. And I think the United States can, and in my judgment, will contribute to the implementation of the agreed roadmap.
I want to read you something from the last few pages of your own biography written in 1995, 9 years ago. You wrote then, "My life's work is not yet done. The final crowning chapters of my biography are still being written at this time. They deal with the subject closest to my heart, peace. We are ending a decades-long history dominated by war and embarking on an era in which the guns will stay silent while dreams flourish. Do you still believe that?
Oh, yes. I think we are today nearer to peace than ever before. With all the pessimism, you know, we made peace with Egypt. We made peace with Jordan. We are now negotiating with the Palestinians. All those could hardly have had happened before the Kippur War. Now, 10 years is a long time in personal terms. In national terms, historic terms, it's not a very long period of time. And if I can guess, as dangerous as it may be to guess, in the coming 5 to 10 years, we shall see a comprehensive peace in the Middle East, in my judgment.
And will you be in public service at that time? Is there going to come a time when the Perezes and the Sharons need to step aside for a younger generation of leaders in Israel?
100%. I think, you know, at our age, we have one advantage. We don't have to serve ourselves anymore. We have to pave a way for a young generation in order to save them to go through all the troubles and death and disappointments that we went through. And when Sharon and myself are talking, we say, we know our age. We are free and we are committed to make a way for a younger generation that can start with peace and not wind up with war.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Shimon Peres, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, former Prime Minister of Israel. The Connection is produced by Alan Cockle, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Brett Granger, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.